Life is full of hassles, way more than you might think, certainly more than when you think when you're growing up. So you've got to plan your future. You've got to do financial planning. You've got to get insurance. But to get peace of mind, you've got to make sure your family is legally protected. So where do you turn, and where have I turned in the past, for affordable legal protection you can trust? LegalZoom.com. That's right. Our friends at LegalZoom.com have been there for over 12 years, helping Americans get personalized wills, powers of attorney, living trust, real estate documents, and more. LegalZoom also helps start and maintain businesses with incorporation and LLC filings, trademarks, and copyrights. Time-saving services were developed by a team of experienced attorneys, and LegalZoom takes care of you from start to finish. And then they follow up on you, too. You'll get emails throughout the year telling you your certain things are due and are you paying attention to things. It's quite a service. LegalZoom documents have been accepted by courts and government agencies in all 50 states. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they can connect you to an attorney and provide self-help services at your specific direction. For even more savings, enter Drew, D-R-E-W, in the referral box at checkout. If you're a parent or entrepreneur, don't forget, don't wait any longer. Call or visit LegalZoom.com and protect what is yours.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. We are switching gears a little bit for this program, and we are going to talk to Amy Kramer from the National Campaign to End Teen and Unwanted Pregnancy. Amy, you there?
I sure am.
Amy and I have known each other for a long time, and Amy is a magnificent person, and you've been at the campaign for 15 years, yes?
It just seems like 15 years. I've been there about 7 years.
7 years. Okay. You did 15 years working at like Good Morning America and
exactly.
CNN and that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Where you and I developed a ton of mutual friends.
Exactly.
So I want people to my goals today are to sort of survey the scene. What's going on with particularly teen pregnancy, and we can talk about unwanted pregnancy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why it's happening, what the trends have been, and let's just start.
Where did
the national campaign get started and why?
Well, the national campaign was founded in 1996. In his State of the Union that year, I believe President Clinton called for a national campaign to prevent teen pregnancy. And a bunch of well-meaning folks in Washington got together and put together this leadership group that is the national campaign. And, you know, we're not like other groups in that we don't have chapters or affiliates. We work sort of across all sectors, which is how you and I work together. You know, we work on policy and research and media and in states and communities because the work of teen pregnancy prevention happens all over the place. It happens in schools, it happens in churches, it happens in families. It happens in all kinds of youth-serving organizations. And so we work, as a leadership group, to help those who are in the field doing this important work accomplish those goals.
So how bad was it in 96?
Well, the teen pregnancy rate in the early 90s was about 4 in 10 girls in this country got pregnant at least once before the age of 20.
Think about that. So of every 4... teenagers, every 10 teenagers, 4 got pregnant. And,
exactly.
And I imagine in some areas it was ridiculously worse.
Right. I mean, it's not the same across every community or every race, ethnicity, or every socioeconomic group, but it's a big enough problem in every community and group that there's no one-size-fits-all. Like, if we can just solve it here, then we're fine.
Right.
You know, this is and it's also the impact of teen pregnancy and childbearing isn't just felt by that girl and her child and her family and her community. I mean, as taxpayers, we are all on the hook for, at this point, it's about $11 billion a year.
Let's do that math a little bit. So that was roughly, you know, 18 years ago, basically, that it was 4 in 10. And you said the early 90s it was 4 in 10
mm-hmm.
throughout.
Right.
So let's say 20 years ago.
Right.
And so those kids are now young adults.
Correct.
Are you guys studying those kids and what kind of an impact they're having on the social order?
I am personally not studying them, but there are all sorts of people who do research, you know, through the CDC and other places in the federal government and all over the place who are studying the impacts of teen childbearing. And, I mean, the short answer to that is that teens children born to teens face more challenges than children who are born into better circumstances. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. You know, kids who are born into less than ideal circumstances face all sorts of challenges, whether it's physical. You know, a teenager is not necessarily equipped to carry a pregnancy to term. So children born to teens are often at risk for low birth weight and other, you know, issues that can develop of that. They're born into circumstances where, you know, where there might be more abuse and neglect. Certainly there's a lot of father absence kinds of issues.
Let's share the math on that. How many of the teen fathers stick around?
Not many. When you talk about marriage, which is an easier thing to count because there are marriage certificates and that's like a legal thing, about 8 out of 10 dads don't marry the teen mother of their child. You have, you know, a proportion where they stay together, but that isn't always forever. And in fact, you know, the majority of families that are born of teen pregnancy are not intact. About 80%, yeah. You know, 80% of teen moms aren't married to the biological father. About more than half are not living with the biological father. And of those who are not living with the father, you know, about a quarter of them say they avoid each other altogether. Mm. You know, and that's just in studies that are done, you know, within the first year after a birth.
It gets
worse. You and I have seen, for example, being involved with 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom with MTV, that sometimes things can be good for a year.
Right.
Or half a year.
Right.
But life is long.
Right. It's never. Of all those kids, I remember congratulating some of the dads on 16 and Pregnant Teen Mom for sticking around. They're all gone.
Right.
They're just gone.
Yeah.
And some of them, it's like, you know, where's you know, Tony or Billy or whatever. I don't know. He moved.
Right. And, you know, I mean, trying to stay in a relationship and stay together with the person that you love at the age of 16 or 17 is, you know, like I said, life is long. And I don't think, you know, I think there are many people who wouldn't choose that relationship to be their forever relationship, which is fine, except for when you have a child together. There's a lot more at stake and a lot more involved. You have to figure out a way to co-parent with someone. That's really difficult at any age when it's someone you don't even really want to talk to.
Of the kids that were born during that epidemic, and we'll talk later about what the data is now, but they're in their 20s now. Are they as likely to become a teen parent? Are they more likely to be monogamous or successful with a marriage? Is there any data like that?
Are they more likely to stay in poverty? Well, certainly it's a lot harder. If you're born into poverty, it's a lot harder to climb out of poverty.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the best ways to eliminate child poverty is to not have kids born into child poverty. You know, I mean, there was a study done, I don't know, maybe half a dozen years ago about if the teen birth rate hadn't declined as it has over the past two decades, how many more children would be living in poverty? And the numbers are astonishing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult. I mean, there's always a debate, does teen pregnancy cause poverty or does poverty cause teen pregnancy? But I think if you're living in that situation, you know, the chicken or the egg isn't really the issue.
The issue
is how do you move on and get and make a better life for yourself? And it's hard enough without a kid in tow as a young person.
So what has happened to the dad in the last couple of decades?
Well, since the early 90s, the teen birth rate in this country has declined by 49%.
That's great.
I mean, chew on that for a second. That's an unbelievable success story any way you slice it. There's never been that kind of success on an issue, on a social issue or a medical issue in that span of time that I can think of. I mean, can you imagine if the obesity epidemic was halved
all of a sudden? Yeah.
You know, or smoking, or I mean any assortment of things. And again, teen pregnancy is a very complex social and health issue because number one, there are new teenagers every year. It's not like we have a vaccine and it's like, okay, we solved this, moving on.
Right.
Every year we have, you know, there are new teenagers and there are new pressures and all of those things. So it really it has to be an effort that builds on itself and that continues.
And when did the decline begin?
The decline began in the early 90s. And it's declined pretty consistently since then with there was a 5% increase between, I believe it was 2005-2006, mm-hmm. which at the time was very alarming because it was, after 15 years of steady progress, was this the end of that success story?
What do you think that was?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm sure that there are number crunchers who can figure out, you know, based on demographics and this and that. But that was just a one-time blip. And since then, since 2007, it's gone down like another 25%. So that really was, thankfully, a one-time thing. But again, there are so many things that feed into this issue.
What do you mean?
It's personal. It's political. It has to do with love and feelings and sex and families and, you know, all of these things that are not easily unpacked and fixed.
Is there some sort of initiative or some cultural shift that you think really got things sort of moving in the right direction, other than the attention that was sort of directed to it in the 90s? Is there stuff that really worked?
Well, I think... there are a lot of things. I mean, the only things that prevent pregnancy at any age, but also with teens, is either not having sex or using protection every single time. And so these declines are the result of a combination of those two things. Certainly there has been more and better sex ed in recent decades, not every place, but in certain,
Was there a backwards movement in the early, mid-2000s?
Well, there was, you know, I mean, I certainly don't want to refight the abstinence wars. I mean,
But is that when that was heating up? That whole abstinence thing was in 2005, 2006? Or was it before that?
The abstinence stuff was in the early 2000s, yes. But, you know, the thing about abstinence is that abstinence, you know, that is not having sex, is a great way to prevent pregnancy. It's like the number one way to prevent pregnancy.
Can I just give an aside now, or just a quick off? Get off this topic for a quick second. No, but it was because you may have a perspective on this. I found fascinating. I was talking to a friend of mine who was taking aim at the HPV vaccine and going, "Oh no, look at the way the drug company manipulated this and rushed it to market and made." And I thought, "Are you kidding? It was politicized and delayed for 15 years.
Right?
It was made politicized behind the veil of it's going to make young people have sex, as opposed to it's going to save 20,000 lives a year. It's unbelievable that now that story is told as, oh, the drug companies pushed this thing out. Do you remember how awful that was?
Stuff is absurd.
But you remember it was there was anti-science being pushed out of the administration aimed at this vaccine to delay it from ever coming to market. They did everything they could. It must have been delayed 10 years, remember?
Yeah, I mean, that was before I worked in the sort of teen pregnancy world. But, you know, there is a lot of history with Big Pharma, as you know.
Oh no, listen, I'm not defending Big Pharma.
People have, you know, a lot of very deeply held feelings about all of that.
But isn't it bizarre how those feelings are clouding history? The history this was a political hot potato that really corroded science for 10 years. And looking back, people go, oh, it's the drug companies rushing it out. It's like, oh, no, no, no.
Right.
No.
I mean, people love to, you know, to employ facts, which, if true, would be great. And I think you see some of that kind of stuff now with emergency contraception and whether it should be available
100%.
To teens or not.
Exact same stuff. The same people, the same nonsense. And I want an apology from everyone who insisted that the emergency contraceptive was an abortion pill. I lived through 20 years of that going, hey, guys, I've looked at the biology. That ain't how it works. It's just not how it works. So, it's abortion pill. Why? Because somehow it encourages young people to have sex? I don't think so. What's the data on that? Does the morning after pill throw open the door to wild sexual exploits? What's the data say?
I don't have data on that, unfortunately, but I've done enough focus groups and enough interviews about emergency contraception and the emergency contraception is something that was, you know, invented long after my teens and 20s. So I don't have sort of the firsthand knowledge of like what it's like to be in college when emergency contraception is available. But among, you know, women that I've talked to, women in their 20s, that, you know, many people have used it. I mean, the CDC put out numbers earlier this year that about, I think it's one in three women between the, you know, age 24 and younger have used it. I mean, this is a widely used method of contraception. Very few people are happy about using it.
Well, it's
you
not,
know, it's not the kind of thing where you're like, oh, and now I'm going to do this. It's
well,
more
it's,
like
it's an emergency measure.
Exactly.
I used to do a campaign with the American Medical Women's Association, and we had these fire extinguishers. That was our big thing. It was like because you keep a fire extinguisher in your kitchen doesn't mean you're going to have a fire in your kitchen or you're going to light your kitchen on fire.
But right.
Should
I mean, you're
you
be safe?
But
in
should you have a fire, you better damn well have that fire extinguisher. So we were advocating that women should have this emergency contraceptive available. And,
right.
And now we're getting closer to that. How about the teen availability, that the newer initiatives, which are is again based on science? What are you guys feeling about that?
Well, there was a decision recently in the past few months by the federal courts that say that emergency contraception should be available to women of all ages, including teenagers. Right now, you have to be 17 or older, and so there was a decision that. That would say that teens of any age can buy it without having to show ID. And I believe, you know, right now, if you, no matter how old you are, when you buy emergency contraception, you have to go to the pharmacist. You don't need a prescription if you're 17 or older, but you have to go to the pharmacist. They keep it behind that counter.
Right, where they used to keep the condoms.
Right. But I believe that with this new decision that they're going to have to move that out and put it on the shelves, like next to the maxi pads.
No,
you know,
like
it's going to have to be the kind of thing that you don't have
no,
to
be
go
next to
ask
the,
someone's permission.
It'll be next to the condoms where it should be.
Right.
And by the way, do you think the world's going to implode when that happens? Or has the world imploded since that decision? The world spun off its axis? No, of
course. So far not. But we don't know if that's going to be enacted because the Justice Department has to decide whether or not they're going to appeal that.
Ugh.
And we're in sort of that limbo waiting period right now. But at some point in the next couple of months, we're going to have an answer on this.
So there was a decline. Excuse me. There was an increase in pregnancies 2005, 2006.
Increase in the birth rate, in the
teen
birth rate.
And we could talk all day about whether that was related to the abstinence education debate that didn't seem to have a positive impact. Anyway, let's say that. In 2007, it got back on track again. Have there been specific policies or phenomenon that have significantly positively contributed to that reduction in teen pregnancy rates?
Well, there have been a lot of things. I mean, I think one thing is the increase in education around HIV and AIDS.
But that was huge in the 90s, you know? It was huge.
Right, that was huge in the 90s. And again, we saw rates decline by 20-some-odd percent
but,
in the 90s.
But am I wrong, though, that the rate has sort of accelerated in the last 5 or 6 years, the rate of decline? Or has it just been a steady slope?
It's been a steady decline again, you know, since the early 90s, except for that blip in the mid-2000s. And then it has declined precipitously since, I mean, 25% since 2007.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So what's
right.
happening?
So there are a lot of things that feed into that. I mean, HIV and AIDS education, again, is still a big deal and also captures sort of the imagination of teen boys in the way that perhaps earlier teen pregnancy prevention efforts, you know, were always focused on girls.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. There's been certainly a lot more media coverage of it.
Of teen pregnancy.
Of teen pregnancy and teen parenthood and the consequences. I mean, again, you and I have worked, you know, with the MTV shows a lot. And, you know, those shows are very good at showing the exact right audience what the consequences are.
And do you think it's had the desired impact?
Well, I certainly think it started a lot of conversation. I mean, the thing about teen pregnancy is that it's 100% preventable. You just have to really try hard to do it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a million other things that can derail your life.
You don't have to build a sanity.
Or, having a parent who's ill or something. You know, this is something, it's up to you.
Well, also, you don't have to build an infrastructure to drop it. You don't have to build a sanitation system or something. You just got to get people to change their behavior.
Exactly. And, you know, if you've never even considered what it would be like if this happened to you, then you probably wouldn't consider a whole lot about preventing it and how you might prevent it in your own life.
Well, not only do they not consider preventing it, they see it as a goal and some sort of solution to their problems. And I think the Teen Mom programs showed them the reality, so they could no longer stay in that denial or that magical thinking about what a pregnancy would do for them.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I don't think there's anything on 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom that experts who've worked in this field for years have, you know, haven't said before.
Yeah.
But it's being presented again, again, to the exact right audience in a way that is incredibly relevant and meaningful to them.
Yes.
You know, teenagers see 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom a lot differently than grown-ups do. You know, 8 out of 10 teenagers say that watching those shows helps them understand the challenges.
Yeah.
Whereas grown-ups are more likely to say, well, this is glamorizing teen pregnancy. You know, I mean, and again, those are more often than not people who haven't actually seen the show. Because,
right.
I mean, as you know, there's nothing glamorous about it. And you can't watch any episode of those series for 5 minutes and not see someone crying and regretful and... You know, but pregnancy is very complicated, because having children is a wonderful thing and probably the most wonderful thing people ever do with their lives.
Right, that's the conundrum.
You know, but it, you know, it's about sequencing and how, what kind of a parent do you want to be, and when are you going to be ready to be that parent, and the sacrifices that that entails, and that's not a good match for teenagers most of the time.
What do you think the future holds for this?
Well, I mean, my dearest hope is obviously that the rates continue to decline and that more children are born into wanted and welcome circumstances, and that young people understand that making decisions about pregnancy prevention isn't just protecting their bodies and their futures, but, it, you know, it's protecting your feelings, and it's a very complicated thing.
Now, I know you guys don't get into this topic, but do you think that how young people see relationships and within that marriage needs to be kind of addressed someday? Because they don't see child rearing, marriage as a related to child rearing. You know what I mean?
No, that's very true. We were part of a research effort very recently that, I mean, I can send you can post it. It's fascinating about women in their 20s are much more likely to have a child than a husband.
You guys get that study, put it up on our site. So I'm not surprised by that data. I know that's kind of how young people think, that, you know, oh, baby, that's, you know, I'm ready for that. But marriage, why would I want to do that? What's you know, why would I get married? That's
right.
That's tough, man. I don't want to get married. And by the way,
right. I mean, one of the findings in this study is that people are now looking at marriage as more of a capstone to their adult lives rather than a cornerstone, where it used to be you got married and you kind of figured it out together. You know, how you were going to live and how you were going to parent and how you were going to, you know, be adults in the world. And now people want to figure that out and then get married.
And so what function does marriage serve in their mind? It has no childbearing, child rearing sort of function. It has no economic function, seeming in their minds. What are
right,
they?
But I mean, I think the thing is that there actually is a function for that, because children who grow up in two-parent families or who grow up, you know, who grow up in circumstances like that, by every measure that we have, seem to fare better.
Categorically,
and I think economically,
this
is not my area of expertise.
No,
so
but I, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I think the reason we evolved these institutions like marriage is so we could effectively reproduce and get another generation into the world. Otherwise, we really wouldn't have it. And so why don't young people know that it's a necessary? Let's call it what it is, a necessary feature of healthy, you know, rearing healthy children.
Well, you know, I think that there are kids who grow up without those role models in their lives, you know, so it doesn't seem necessary because, you know, their mom didn't have that or their dad didn't have that.
Not of that, I think they have the opposite. They, it looks like a source of pain to them.
Because, and that too, you
yeah.
know, when you grow up in a family that's rife with conflict.
Failed,
and other,
yeah. The institution failed them.
You know, so you want to, you know, the pendulum swings all the way backwards. I mean, the divorce rate is lower now than it has been in some time. Again, the marriage rate is also lower. So, you know, that math seems to make sense.
Well, it's just, it's a lower percentage of a lower number, but okay.
Right.
All right. Well, so again, going forward, are there initiatives and policies and things we should look forward to and support that can really help this, or things we can do in our own communities?
Yes, I'm glad that you asked, because May is Teen Pregnancy Prevention Month. Mm-hmm. So there are a bunch of things that are going on. So May 1st is a national day to prevent teen pregnancy, but the whole month of May is Teen Pregnancy Prevention Month. And there are all kinds of things going on in states and communities, you know, coast to coast, all over the place. But what the day and the month is an excuse, is a time for people to take stock and for grown-ups who care about young people to talk to them about this. I'm not saying it's the easiest conversation in the world to have, but it's one of the most important. And one of the things that we do to facilitate those sorts of conversations is on our website for teens, which is stayteen.org, we have a
What is it?
Stayteen.org.
S-T-A-Y.
Stayteen.org.
Stayteen.org, okay. We'll put a web. Yep.
And if you go to stayteen.org through the month of May, we have a game, a sort of a quiz game. And we've done this for the last dozen years. Last year we had, I think it was 700,000 teenagers played the game or took the quiz. And what it does is, you make an avatar of yourself, of the person you like, you know, the boy, the girl that you like, and a friend, and you go through these certain scenarios and figure out what kind of advice would you give to a friend, what would you do in the heat of the moment? Because, again, like we've talked about, you can prevent this from happening in your life. You just have to want to.
Right.
And the best time to figure that out is before you're in the heat of the moment.
Right. And really, I think, you know, having those conversations with kids are so vital. It really, even if kids resist and push back and don't want to hear it, you're communicating your values and your knowledge and your experience gets through.
Right. And, you know, in teenagers, I mean, we do polling on this, you know, every couple of years, and we ask teenagers what has the most impact on your decisions about sex, and it's parents.
Always.
Not the media, it's not friends, it's not, you know, it's not anything else, it's parents. So I think that should actually be a really empowering thing for moms and dads to know, that even when your kids aren't, you know, even when they act like they're not listening, they're getting the message. And as parents, if we can treat parenting like the important lifelong job that it is, and we can talk to our kids about, you know, this is hard work, this is important hard work, and someday you will be a great parent, and that day isn't yet, you know?
Yes.
And making sure, and I mean, this is another thing you and I have talked about in the past. Parents need to talk to their kids about contraception.
Yeah.
It's not giving them permission to have sex. It's giving them the tools to be safe.
Telling them to wear a seatbelt every time they drive their car is not giving them permission to speed.
Right. Telling your teenager to call you if they drink or if their ride is drinking, and you'll come pick them up, because what you really, I mean, you don't want them to drink, obviously, but if they do, what you really want is for them to be safe.
Yep.
You know, it's the same thing. I mean, you can tell a teenager, I can give you 100 reasons why you shouldn't have sex and why you should wait, and we can talk about all of those reasons, but if you are going to, you need to be safe.
Well, Amy, I'm going to say goodbye to you now. It's thenationalcampaign.org. Amy Kramer is the director of Entant Media, the National Campaign to End Teen and Unwanted Pregnancy.
Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy.
What did I say? Unwanted? Oh,
yes.
Nasty.
Unplanned.
Unplanned.
The National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. It's a mouthful.
And a reminder that as many as 50% of women will experience an unplanned pregnancy in their lifetime. Isn't that the right data?
That's about right. And actually, just one more thing on the teen thing. As important as this issue is among teens, and it's vitally important, obviously, the numbers are actually much greater among young unmarried women in their 20s.
Of course.
I mean, which, if you think about it, makes sense, because people in their 20s have more sex than teens, and, you know, but the outcomes, both for the woman and for the child, aren't that different. I mean, if you're not done with school, if you're not in a stable financial situation and a lifelong relationship, it's hard. It doesn't matter if you're 19 or if you're 22. I mean, there's no magic in becoming 20.
There is a researcher by the name of Alan Sroof at, I think it was University of Wisconsin, when he did these studies, and he looked at longitudinal studies, lifetime of kids, and he found the one, and someone asked him at a conference, what's the one thing you would give a single mom of a child? And he said, an available, supportive partner. Doesn't that
right.
be a, but whatever they need, another set of hands, another set of eyes, another brain to raise a child. You can't do it alone. It's almost impossible to do in a healthy way. Okay, the website is thenationalcampaign.org. Anything else we should refer to? Is stayteen.org?
Stayteen.org, absolutely, especially through the month of May. The game is great, and it's a great way to get young people thinking about what they would do in the heat of the moment before that moment.
Great. Thanks so much, Amy. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Drew.
And we will take a quick break back with phone calls after this. Allison
Rosen. Hey, everyone, it's me, Allison Rosen. This week on Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend, I sat down with Saturday Night Live's Bobby Moynihan, and we talked about comedy, love, action figures, appearing on camera in his underwear, why he reads Jay Mohr's book every summer, and the inspiration for his first SNL sketch.
I waited on a couple once, and when I walked over to them, I said, hey, can I get you guys something? And they were not looking at me. They were, like, doing that baby talk, kissing kind of thing. And I literally was standing at the edge of the table, and they were not talking to me. And the guy said to the girl, he was like, I love you, girl. and she was like, thank you. And he goes, yo, it smells like Peppa up in here. And I literally wrote it down and then did it for many years at UCB. And they just talked about how it smelled like Peppa in the restaurant. So I just essentially just did that. Just a waiter who thought everything smelled like Peppa.
Subscribe to Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend on iTunes or go to AllisonRosen.com. New episodes every Monday and Thursday. I love you.
Allison's your new best friend. Back with the Dr. Drew podcast. That was Amy Kramer from the National Campaign to End Teen and Unplanned, not Unwanted, as I improperly said, Unplanned Pregnancy. Check out those websites. She's been doing this work for a long time. I've known her for a while, and it's been great to see the success. And the misery. I mean, Carolla's been screaming about this forever. Remember his if you were a Loveline listener back in the day, even back in the 90s, I'm sure if you go to the classic stuff at Podcast One, you'll hear him saying, screwed up people having screwed up kids. Well, young people by definition. I was screwed up when I was an adolescent. Who wasn't? All right, let's get to your phone calls. Reminder, by the way, the Adam and Drew Reunion Tour, Uptown Theater, May 18th in Napa. Also, the Adam and Drew Reunion Tour CD is available now. It's available on iTunes, a download for $4.99, which is highlights from the last three we've done, Salt Lake, Vegas, and
the first three, actually.
First three. So it's Bakersfield, Santa Barbara, and somewhere
Denver.
Yeah. Denver was a good one. So if you want to wonder what happens at those tours, you can listen to it. Get to work on Salt Lake. That was another good one. Be sure you put in the flag part. That was hysterical. And by the end, when I tell the Ray story, I think that was in Salt Lake too. So, all right. Anyway, we'll go out to your calls. Let's see. Oh, by the way, yes, I'll do my Carolla thing and mention to click through at the Amazon link at drdrew.com. And it doesn't cost a thing, but keeps the pirate ship afloat. Going out to your calls now. This is Patrick in New York. Patrick.
Hey, Dr. Drew.
Hey there, buddy. What's going on?
Hey, I'm a longtime supporter of you, and I've heard you talk about addiction many a time.
Yeah.
One of the things I've heard you say, you can kind of gauge someone's addiction by taking a look at what consequences they have
from
taking that substance.
Yes.
So as of the first of the year, being 25-year-old male, I was 500 pounds. So you can imagine I had quite a bit of consequences from overeating.
Oh, my God. Was it all overeating, or was there some genetic component to this, too?
Oh, no, it was entirely overeating. I mean, the consequences I have, obviously you can imagine just the lifestyle, having friends, that decreases. Your health decreases. But even financially, I was eating out, takeout every single day. So as of the first of the year, $2,500 in debt on the credit card because I was eating out every day.
Wow. Patrick, that's crazy.
Yeah. So since then, luckily, I've lost 110 pounds.
Congratulations.
So I'm on the road. I appreciate it. I am on the road to get into a better spot. But the question is, that biological change in your brain that causes addiction, is it the same for food as it is for cocaine or marijuana or alcohol?
It's the same region, for sure. The ventral tegmental inputs into the nucleus accumbens. In fact, a lot of the original research on reward was done on food and sex and that sort of thing. But chemicals, meaning drugs, activate that system in an extra physiological way. So the question is, why are you going at it in a way that sort of exceeds normal physiology? And usually, more often, you know, when someone does that, there's some sort of traumatic event that triggers that really superpowers the need for that reward. I remember one woman that had terrible food addiction, terrible, told me eventually, and again, if you have the genetic history of addiction, I mean, that's what puts a little rocket fuel behind this. That's what causes the genetic changes that result in the progressive need for this reward. But when it comes to food, when I've seen it be completely out of control, there's one case comes to mind for me. It was a woman who was sexually abused by her father on a regular basis. He would, as a little girl, like a six-year-old, would require her, make her give him oral sex, and at the end would give her milk and cookies and pet her and say, "It's because I love you so much. Here, eat this." And that triggering, that mechanism of reward became messed up. The wiring became messed up, and she could not stop eating. Could not stop. Was it? Did you have any trauma?
Oh God, I've been listening to you long enough. I knew you would ask that. Yeah, I guess there was some trial and child stuff when I was real young, but that's the extent of what I recall.
Was it oral sex? Interestingly.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? I've just asked that because that's the association I've seen out there with food compulsions. Did it go on for a little while?
Oh, yeah, for a number of years.
Okay, so that would make sense, right?
Unfortunately, yeah, it does.
You don't really sound like a trauma survivor. Have you worked on that?
I have not at all, no. And I've stuck it in the back of my head, and you are the first person I've ever said that to out loud, ever.
Yeah, and you know from listening to us how common it is. It's terribly, terribly common. And you also, and you know it also, that's kind of what people do to survive it. They kind of put it away in a drawer somewhere. But unfortunately, that drawer is fueling something. It's not integrated with the rest of yourself, literally, and your brain. It's just sitting there fueling the need to be, in your case, fed. And that's kind of interesting that I would use that language. I don't know where that came from, but that's what I felt compelled to say. Let me ask you this. How did you get to that moment of change? Because that really interests me. How you're 500 pounds for years and years, you have this trauma stuff tucked away, and one day you go, I am changing direction. Did something lead up to that?
I don't think there was. Nothing big. It was just you get to the point where I would get out of breath putting my clothes on in the morning. And I was I work in a professional environment, need a nice button up. And you go to the fat guy store, the casual male XL, and there's no more shirts to fit you. And that's the point where, like, if I get any bigger, I don't even know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to wear and put on my body to work. And so I wasn't fitting in this world anymore. I felt outside of this world. I felt like a circus freak. Wow. And I was like, I need to change something. So I made some 8-minute long video, stuck it on YouTube. I'm like, I'm making a change. I'm making it now. There's no turning back. Because it wasn't a year ago where I did this, where I lost 80 pounds in 15 weeks. But after that, I gained 150 back.
Wow.
So it's this roller coaster that kind of started. High school is normal size, but ever since high school, for the last 7 years, I shot up, and I had to make a decision to change, and that's what I've been doing.
Have your relationships changed at all? Have you developed any new friendships?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But no, before you made the change, before you started losing weight, has anything – I would just wonder because – tell me before I –
I don't think there was – I still had the same friends. Nothing drastic changed.
What I've noticed is in people I've spoken to that are able to make big change all of a sudden, they'll sometimes say, you know, I was hanging out with this girl or this guy that kind of interested me. I don't normally hang out with that kind of person. We'd sit and talk and share ideas. And I don't know. He kind of got under my skin. Something about a new experience of yourself in a relationship with somebody. Does that ring a bell at all?
I guess it does a little bit, yes, but not in terms of a romantic.
No, never romantic. Right. Never romantic. It's always just a novel friendship.
Oh yeah, it was definitely a novel friendship. Just someone I met at work who is definitely type A personality that I typically kind of steer away from in my friendships.
And Patrick, that is exactly what people tell me. They say this is not the kind of person I normally hang out with. Not always the typical A part. It might be somebody who's hippy dippy. But if for whatever reason, it's some part of yourself that you don't normally engage in with another person. And they'll always say the same thing. They'll go, yeah, I just had this guy that I at work or at school or whatever. I would not normally get near that guy. For whatever reason, that's not somebody I would hang out with. But suddenly I found myself hanging out with this guy. And lo and behold, we got close as friends. Mm-hmm. And there you go. What's the guy's name?
Otis. I'm actually sitting in front of his house right now.
Okay. You need to go in and thank Otis. Because I'm telling you, somehow that figures into these massive moments of change. I don't know how. It's like a part of yourself doesn't get engaged unless you have these new parts coming in from other people. Does that make sense?
Right. It absolutely does.
Yeah. And maybe it'll also, as you continue to grow, you may notice you start to get depressed a little bit too as the world starts to come back into you, literally, as you don't have that big buffer around you. And then maybe that'll motivate you to do some work on the trauma too then.
Hmm? Maybe. We'll have to see.
Well, you sound great, Patrick. It's a delight to talk to you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Yep. Keep going, all right? Let us know how it goes. Call me back in a few months. Tell me about how much more weight you lost.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully you'll see me on Biggest Loser. I'm heading out to Boston next weekend to try and get on the show.
Oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
If you do get on it, I'm blanking on her name. What's the host name? Everybody help me.
I know Jillian Michaels is on.
No. The blonde host. I've noticed since she was four. Allison. I've noticed since she was Allie, we call her. Allison Sweeney. I've known her since she was 14. And she is delightful. So if you do get on the show, please say hello to her for me, will you?
Absolutely.
All right. Good luck, Patrick.
Thanks so much.
Right, bye. Yeah, she used to be on the Adam. I remember her, too. She went to my kids' high school, but before my kids were born. And she used to come on when she was a child on Loveline, when she was a teen actor on a daytime drama back in the day. What's up there, John?
Hello, Dr. Pinsky. I want to thank you ahead of time for saving me my $20 copayment this week.
John, what's happening? My pleasure.
And I promise we'll go right to the show if it's helpful.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for that.
I just wanted to ask you, what do you think as far as how long should I wait before I start dating again? I was married 15 years, and it's been a few months now, and got three kids, single dad. What do you recommend?
Well, give me the whole story here. You're calling from Massachusetts. What part?
Western Massachusetts.
Where? Pioneer Valley?
Yeah.
Whereabouts? Holyoke?
Westfield.
Westfield, Mass. All right.
I
went to college out there. I'm going out there on Friday, in fact. I'm going out there. Go
Lord Jeffs.
Go Lord Jeffs. But I'm going to see the East. I'm going up to Williamstown to see my son kick William's ass. Anyway. You have three kids. How old are they?
All in high school, senior, junior, and freshman.
And what happened to your marriage? You're married for 15 years. What went down?
Long story short, she decided to be with somebody else.
Was she cheating all along, or was there acrimony in the relationship, or what happened?
It's definitely been bumpy the last few years. I can say that I've done my best to try to work on it, and I think, people look to different things to make themselves feel better.
Hey, John, I'm gonna use my Jedi powers. I smell alcohol here. Does she drink?
She was dry for a while, and I think she's starting up again.
I smell alcoholic here. Just smells of alcoholism. I don't know why, but I could just – it's like literally I can almost smell alcohol.
Yeah, so, she tried some program and didn't stick with it, the more it just repelled. So, I did my part.
John, people don't try a program unless they're alcoholics. Alcoholics go to programs and fail. Non-alcoholics don't go to programs. So she's an alcoholic. She's actively drinking. And as a part of that, she got going with a guy.
Correct.
Were you writing her about her drinking? Were you sort of nagging her about it?
Well, I was. I would say a few years ago, I went to Al-Anon, and pretty much it was suggested, just back off. And that's what I did. I worked my program, kind of, let her go in that way, just focused on myself. She lost somebody close in her family, and then it ended up, using maybe it was a time of weakness. I don't know.
John, it's alcoholism straight out. But I mean, why did I magically knew this is alcoholism? It doesn't say on the board that life's a drinker. I could just – that's how alcoholics behave. But I also smell a second problem here, like a character, trauma, whatever thing going on, which is why she couldn't tolerate the loss of the parent or whatever that was.
Sibling, something
she couldn't tolerate. So there's a little more going on. You sound like a great guy. You've worked a program. Thank God you're whole. How are your kids?
It's been adjustment. I can just say that. I think the biggest thing is, obviously having a safe place here that's an anchor, something just trying to keep stable and keep it going. There's definitely been some, interesting issues just as far as who's going to live with who, but, you know, I'm kind of old enough for them to make their own decisions.
Yeah, and remember, at least one of those kids is going to get that gene, right? You probably already know who it is.
That's what I've heard, right?
Yeah, keep an eye on that. And the others, you know, you may want to take with you to Al-Anon, send them some Alateen meetings or therapy, whatever, you know, you make sure that they're, you know, looked after psychologically, because this stuff, it rocks kids. It just does. Okay, well, John, I say, how long have you been divorced?
It's been about four months.
I say now. I'm dropping the checkered flag on you. I think you were in awfully good shape. You sound fantastic, in fact, compared to the average divorcee in terms of your insight, your sort of okayness. You know, you've taken care of yourself. You're taking care of your kids. I think you go date. I think that's fine. I think it's going to be tough for you. I think you're going to be very circumspect. Remember, you like alcoholics, so that's going to be sort of where you find your attractions.
Yeah, you know, that's the hard thing. Is, you know, obviously, I feel the more grounded I am, then the better rate you're going to attract. And I'm just feeling,
right.
You know, what am I looking for, and how does that, you know, how does it even happen? You know, we married young, and
how do you find it in Westfield? Better. Well, you know, now it's a new world, man, in terms of the online stuff. Get online, meet that way. Just let the marketplace be more efficient by the use of all the online mechanisms. Why not?
And then keep the distance from the kids, too. I mean, can't that really tough?
No. Keep them out of it. Completely. Yeah. This is just your social. I'm not saying go jump into a relationship. I'm saying go date. And I'm saying start to find out who you are in dating relationships. Again, you're only 36, dude. You're not 55. Okay.
Right.
It's a lot. There's a lot of 30-year-olds out there dating and having successful, fun times. Think in terms of just nurturing yourself with spending time with people, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you sound great, man. Good luck. Congratulations on managing a tough situation in a kind of a healthy way. But it does feel like a little more mental health services might be good for the kids and whatnot. Okay.
All right, $20 to the partnership. There. Thanks, Drew.
All right, John. Good luck. Take care now.
Take care.
All right. Got a little hat, little tip of the hat to me for the Jedi, sensing this was an alcoholic.
I was very impressed.
Thank you for that. Brittany, 32. What's up, Brittany?
Dr. Drew.
Yes, ma'am.
I actually have a two-part question.
Okay.
One, I actually work in treatment and recovery, and I'm in recovery myself.
How long?
I have 4.5 years.
How's your recovery? Why do I... Well, how's your recovery going, Brittany?
My recovery is going great. I got my master's degree in clinical psychology.
I feel like, listen, this is not meant to be pejorative at all, but I feel like, is there something threatening your recovery, like a relationship or something?
No, not at all.
Are you on any medication right now?
No.
Okay, good. Okay. I just feel like I feel like a little funny insecurity in your voice. It's funny, but okay.
I mean, maybe I'm nervous.
maybe just the call. That's fine. It's just a funny thing I heard. But it's good. Congratulations. 4.5 years is huge, and working in recovery is a big deal, and getting your master's a big deal. That's awesome.
Thank you. So my question's about ADHD.
Yeah.
When do you think is the right time to diagnose it with someone who's early in recovery?
Well, essentially all addicts, and this is going to sound glib, but essentially all addicts meet criteria for ADD. Okay?
Right.
So that's part of the genetics of addiction for most addicts. The question is, how should it be treated and when should it be diagnosed in terms of how severe is it? And at least a year sober, at least a year, and under no circumstances should an adult in recovery with ADD be given a psychostimulant. It will take them out. Every time. May take a year, but they will go out, and they will go out hard.
Okay, because, you know, we deal with addiction psychiatrists, and I was under the impression that it's best to wait a year.
I just said a year. But, Brittany, addiction psychiatry these days, I'm sorry, they will prescribe benzos, they will prescribe psychostimulants, and they will prescribe opiates. It's shocking to me.
No, it's shocking. I deal with it. And, I mean, I see people on Adderall, on Vyvanse.
Yep.
And
disastrous.
I was under the impression use Strattera or
anything. No, you're not under the impression. Well, Strattera, possibly okay. Possibly, but I would avoid it still. But all the stimulants, forget you're under the impression. You know what that does to an addict. You know that activates their disease. Of course, every drug addict feels better on a psychostimulant. They feel even better on meth. Jesus Christ. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all congeners of amphetamine. absolutely no way. Now, a teenager, it's a little bit more complicated. But an adult, it's clear. Brittany, please toe the abstinence line. You know what it's done for you. You know how good it is, right?
Exactly. And one of the psychiatrists, he believes that if your drug of choice was not meth, then it's okay to be on Adderall or another
stimulant. Well, he wait till he sees how that all goes down. Of course, the addicts, after they crash, you know, after spending a year with that psychiatrist telling them what a genius they are and how great they feel, when they do go out, they don't never go back and tell them, hey, asshole, this really fueled my addiction. They never go back, and so they never learn. They just feel lost to follow up. He must be cured. Must be better. So listen, I've seen catastrophes from this. Catastrophes. So please, please, please. You know what abstinence is. People in the program know what abstinence is. And addicts know what happens when they're exposed to opiates, benzos, and stimulants. You know what happens. May not happen immediately, but it happens eventually. Okay?
Thank you.
You toe that line, my dear. You stay with what you know. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. All right. Good luck, my dear. All right. That about does it for the Dr. Drew podcast. Really an interesting, diverse kind of program today. We went through a little bit of teen pregnancy, a little bit of STDs, a little bit of contraception, and a little bit about addiction. Very interesting. All right. So until the next time, it's Dr. Drew. Say goodbye.
This is Corolla Digital.